Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Well, it's Monday. We had a pretty good weekend around my house. We did some outside work before the heavens opened up and decided to rain for, 24 hours or better. But we got some flowers planted outside and starting to get ready for the holidays. So, but of course, that sounds happy, that sounds normal. And then I watch the news and I open up Facebook and I do all those kind of things early in the morning. And I had planned today to talk again about something we've talked about many, many times, which is drug abuse. How many overdoses we read about every day. How often we are in a public situation, and if you're observant, like I tend to be, you look around and you see people under the influence of just such a wide variety of things today. used to be, if you saw somebody standing on the street corner when I was a kid, and everybody was paying attention to him, it was because he was under the influence of alcohol. And of course, alcohol, according to everything I read today, and pretty much according to everything I know as well, is still one of our worst addictions. Why? Because you can do it openly, freely, well, not freely in the sense of not having to pay for it, but openly and freely in many, many, many different arenas. It's totally acceptable behavior. And for some of us, it's fine. I wouldn't want anybody to tell me if I felt like having a glass of red wine, I couldn't have it. But alcoholism is still right up there in the most abusive arenas and ruins people's lives every day. But in the last 10 years, or a little bit better perhaps, we've had this onslaught of prescription drugs. And for many, many years, we have known the trials and tribulations of the obvious drugs, heroin and methamphetamines and LSD. I remember in the late 60s, a friend of mine who went to Cornell University got messed up on LSD, and had we not been in the room with him, he would have jumped out of a second-story window. So all of these things have been around for a very, very long time. But early this morning when I opened up Facebook, I saw this very, very sad story and kind of revamped today's whole story, although we were going to talk about drug abuse, alcohol abuse, etc., because it's the beginning of the holidays. And I think this is the time of year when there is much rejoicing, much happiness, but just as much sadness and depression for various reasons. So let's bring Shell in, and then I want to share a story that was on Facebook this morning and one that I delved into a little bit and read more about. Good morning, Shell.
Well, good morning, Rainey.
How you doing, honey? How was your class all weekend?
I got a thing. My brain definitely feels bigger. I told my sister last night, I said, my brain feels swollen.
Yeah, I'll bet.
A lot of information, huh?
Well, good. So we'll have to share that later. So what I, you know, we've talked about all different kinds of drug abuse. And we've talked about many, many things in regard to alcoholism. We've we've discussed at length marijuana.
Sorry about that. My phone went into searching mode. I lost you for a minute.
Okay. We're going to talk about a story that I found on Facebook this morning. Today's show was going to be about drug abuse and talk a little bit about the fact that during this time of year, and of course, Christmas comes quicker every year, the Christmas holidays. Most people that I know now are decorating their homes for Thanksgiving in, forget the fall and the turkey, they're already decorating for Christmas to celebrate Thanksgiving, which I must be honest, I'm not against, because you do all that work. It's kind of nice to have it serve both holidays and have some fun with it. But the point is that it brings some bad stuff to a lot of people. A lot of people do not celebrate the holidays the way we would like to have them celebrated. They celebrate them in a, or they don't celebrate them. They bring about very, very deep emotions, sometimes a lot of sadness. It's not always a happy time for everybody, depending on what's going on in your life. So we were going to talk about it anyway, and then I found this story, which often happens. On Facebook, there is a picture of a young boy on a gurney, actually a morgue gurney, with a blue sheet covering him up to his neck, with his head on the outside of the sheets. And he's 20 years old, and he overdosed on drugs. And his father, Mike Stallings, decided to post a photo of his body at the funeral home because he feels responsible, he feels guilty, and of course he's grief-stricken. So immediately the picture was shared like 7,700 times, and this young 20-year-old man left behind a young child as well. So I want to read what he wrote because it's very easy to understand, and it's not it's not written by a professional writer, so it really, really comes from his heart. Let's take another look at how fun drugs are. This is my son, about an hour after the funeral home got him late Monday afternoon. When he died, he'd been bleeding out of his ears and had blood in his hair and foam in his mouth. They were kind enough to clean him before we got there. His body was ice cold from being kept in a refrigerator. My cold, dead son. Father of a 10-month-old boy. Grandson to 3 living grandparents. Stepbrother to 2. Half-brother to 3. Son to 2 living parents and a step-parent that helped raise him since he was a young child. All completely devastated. Well, little Asher, that's his son, this man's grandson, is too young to know what is going on, but will live his life wondering what it would be like to know his dad. As many of you know, Jeremy was pretty open about his relationship with LSD. He was a little more quiet about his love for dextromethorphan. I never even heard that one. I guess it's like a derivative of dexedrine or something, or dexed. I don't know. I was going to look it up and got too carried away with all the stories. Despite the begging and pleading from me and many others in his family, he craved the trip and was obsessed about it. Look, I know that not everybody that takes drugs is going to die from it, but many do. Jeremy thought he had it under control. He thought he was smarter than the drug and had more control than the drug. Now he is in a refrigerator in a funeral home in Englewood. Now people are in transit from all across the country to say their final goodbyes. Now my family has to spend over $5,000 in funeral expenses. Now I will never be able to hike with him or ride dirt bikes with him. He will never be able to take his son camping. Those of you that use just for a little fun here and there, you don't have to use, but you like to party a little. Think for a second about how there are those around you with larger mental issues, like Jeremy. he was carrying some mental baggage that even I can't comprehend. By partying with these people, you encourage them and enable them to do it, to use drugs as an escape. That is the very last thing people like this need. These people need actual help. These people need encouragement to heal healthy ways. They need to feel genuine love and uplifting encouragement, not encouragement to get high again. Think about the influence you have on these people. Think about the path of destruction being left behind. People, learn from this. Help make something positive from this tragedy. Walk away from this lifestyle. Find someone that loves you and ask them for help. Don't let this become you. Don't do this to your family. Use our pain and anguish. Learn from it. Turn to someone you love. Get help. If you do not have someone you think you can turn to, message me. I'll do all in my power to help you. It's not too late to save yourself and your family from repeating this horror. Believe me when I say you do not want to experience this, and you do not want your loved ones to have to experience this anguish. Now, you can hear. There's no pictures of this man, but I can almost see him after reading this. I can almost see him writing this and all these different things that are just falling out of his head onto a piece of paper. Is, first of all, therapeutic for him, and I hope it helps somebody. The commentary after this is, this father is to be commended for using the sad experience to educate others and perhaps save some lives. Despite the horrendous grief he must be going through, he is still thinking of others. Stallings humbly blames himself, but we don't know the facts. Some of the best parents have children who take the wrong path in life despite their best efforts. Most likely, the young man was influenced by the bad parts of our culture. Hollywood glamorizing drugs, friends whose parents ignored their drug use, and the do-anything-if-it-feels-right attitude that is promoted. It's too late for this young man, but not for those headed down this path. Hopefully, this photo will continue to be shared everywhere. So, and it is a very, it will be in my mind's eye for many days to come, this picture.
What was this young man's name?
His name is Jeremy, and I'm assuming his last name is Stallings because, it isn't. It's Ratcliffe. Jeremy Ratcliffe, and his father is Mike Stallings.
Okay.
So I think, well, we've talked so much about this. We've talked so many times about drug abuse and how it tears a person apart piece by piece. Every day in the United States, 2,500 youth ages 12 to 17 abuse a prescription pain reliever for the first time. And prescription drug abuse, while most prevalent in the United States, is a problem in many areas around the world, including Europe, South Africa, and South Asia. But in the U.S. alone, more than 15 million people abuse prescription drugs. 15 million people. More than the combined number who reported using cocaine, hallucinogens, inhalants, and heroin. Most of this started really coming to the forefront in 2006. 2.6 million people abused prescription drugs for the first time, according to statistics in 2006. And in 2007, they took a survey and found that 3.3%, which seems like a small amount, of 12 to 17-year-olds and 6% of 17 to 25-year-olds had abused prescription drugs in the past month. The bad part, of course, because it got really, really recognized in 2006 and in 2007, what led up to that was in 2005, there were 22,400 drug overdoses in 2005.
How many?
22,400.
Wow.
And opiates were the most commonly found drug accounting for 38% of those deaths. And in 2005, 4.4 million teenagers in the U.S. admitted to taking prescription drugs. And most of them took them out of their parents' medicine cabinets or out of their mother's purse or wherever they could find them. But in the latest statistics, cause of death, street drugs, all combined with amphetamines, heroin, methamphetamines, and cocaine was 39%. Prescription drugs was 45%. So I think what it is, it's another thing like alcohol. You know what I mean? Because the other things that we're talking about, the heroin, the methamphetamines, the cocaine, all of that stuff has to be gotten illegally. And so many of these other things, of course, the article that I concentrated on this morning didn't talk about pill mills, but we talked about that at length on several different shows. And of course, when they became so prevalent, it was just so easy. All you had to do was go in and say, I'm in such pain in my back. And, of course, you can have back pain with no, unless you do an MRI, an X-ray doesn't show anything wrong, might show some swelling or something like that, but only by a really, really good tech who can see that. So a back pain problem can be, you know, fabricated by anybody. Mm-hmm. And that's what most of them were doing. Here's a quotation from somebody. I realized I was using more Xanax on a regular basis. I took time off from work to get off it. Without the knowledge I was addicted, I went cold turkey. For 4 days and nights, I was bedridden. I didn't sleep or eat. I vomited. I had hallucinations. On about the third day without Xanax, I started to become uncoordinated and unbalanced and bumped into things. On the fourth day, I became really worried when I started having twitching sensations. Now, I have helped people coming off Xanax. And now Xanax, way back, Shell, in the 80s and 90s, Xanax was being handed out to new moms who had postpartum depression. I mean, it was supposed to be something like a Valium that was supposed to take the edge off.
Yep.
So, very. Well, who doesn't? If they're in a bad place mentally, who doesn't want to get away from that? Even the strongest person.
But that's the double edge of this sword. It may give them some relief instantly. You know, or quick. I'm not going to say instantly. It can take weeks. But then the side effects kick in, and then they don't feel so good anymore. So they feel good temporarily, but then as they keep taking it, then they start feeling off again because it alters how you perceive the world. You start losing affect. You start losing the ability to have the appropriate reactions in situations, and people are aware of that. They're aware that all of a sudden they're hearing something that should make them happy or sad, and they're like numb. And that sense of numbness is a form of disconnection, and that's uncomfortable. So here they got some relief from whatever they were experiencing, depression or whatever. Now they're going into numbness. Now they're going into blah. Now they're going into lack of energy, and it's different, but it's making them suffer again.
Well, and it's like anything else. Your body requires more and more and more of something that's taking the edge off, because after a while, your body kind of builds up a resistance to the original dose, and then it's doubled, and then it's tripled, and then it's quadrupled. And then you give somebody a Xanax bar that you can break into four pieces, and people are taking the whole bar.
Have you ever seen the commercials for like Abilify? You know, if you're taking an antidepressant but it's still not working so good, you know, take it with Abilify. And then you hear the laundry list of absolutely horrific side effects at the end. And I'm like, oh, my God, why wouldn't you just, like, go to a shaman and start practicing meditation today? You know, I'm listening to this laundry list of side effects you can have. If you start having involuntary movements of your body, call your physician immediately because they may become permanent. Seriously? How do they know that? How many people have been injured by Abilify that now have like a Parkinson's type disorder where they have movements in their body they can no longer control? And think
right.
about the potential of a drug that could do that to you. What area of your brain is it disrupting?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that's why I'm very, very adamantly against antidepressants, because there's so many natural ways of dealing with depression. There are so many sources of depression. And depending on what your source is how you should appropriately deal with it. But people think that depression is an illness. Depression is a reaction to either a physiological disruption in the body that's creating hormones to be released that make you feel depressed, or it's as a result of an unhappy life, or it's as a result of trauma. So assess why you're feeling depressed. If there's no reason for your depression, then start looking at your lifestyle. Look at what you eat. Look at what your health picture is. Is there some underlying physiological reason? But just to give somebody an antidepressant because they're depressed is incredibly irresponsible, and yet that's what our healthcare industry does. And antidepressants, more than not, have nasty, nasty side effects.
Well, there's two sides to that story, and obviously everything you just said is has validity to it, because we know that. We see that every day. But let's don't forget that there is some truth, and we've read a lot of stuff about this, and we've talked about this, for people with mental illness, not just depression, but real mental illness, have regained some control over their lives with medication. So we can understand how this started. Because way back in the day when Xanax started being so prevalent, that was so a woman didn't get half in the bag in the afternoon when the kids were in bed. She
right.
didn't drink, you know, half a bottle of scotch or something. So it's always been because we see the results of long-term use of anything that alters our feelings, our emotions, our behavior, never is good. It just isn't, because you can't keep doing that. So, but there is some worth when we talk about the electricity in our body and everything, and I don't totally understand this, but I do know that I have been witness to people who can maintain when they're on a regimen of, you know, really monitored, closely monitored drugs to help them maintain some semblance of normalness, you know, mm-hmm. if there is such a thing. So I think a lot of this stuff started out as that, giving people a choice that became also acceptable, like the afternoon cocktail, acceptable to take a sleeping pill because you don't sleep, acceptable to take a pill that gave you a stimulant in the morning because coffee no longer worked. You could drink a whole pot of coffee and you still were sitting there at your desk half asleep. So everything is on a road to better, 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 better. And now we've gotten to the point where it's happening too quickly. There's not enough studies being done on some of the things that we use, and it's created this horrible, horrible problem that we have in the world. And like the thing I just read, it's not just in the United States. It's really all over the world. So
thing you just said, it's not that enough studies aren't being done. Pharmaceutical companies are very, very and I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but they're very cunning. They do the studies that they need to do to get a prescription medication on the market, because by the time that any harm is discovered, they've already made such massive profits that it's going to pay for any lawsuits that come down the line. Every time a new drug has come out in the market, you give it 6 months to a year, and then you see all the commercials on TV for all the class action lawsuits. All right? They've made their money.
But that's what the FDA is supposed to be about, honey. That's what the FDA is supposed to be.
Okay, understand something. All right? And I don't want to get myself in trouble, and I don't want to turn this show into something controversial. The FDA does not protect us, and anybody that thinks that is naive.
I didn't say that. I said that's what it's there for. The Food and Drug Administration is to be monitoring and keeping an eye on the pharmaceutical companies. I'm not saying that they do it either. I'm just saying that that's what they're supposed to be there for.
Right. Well, that's what the American public thinks the FDA is there for. It's actually not. All right. Now, there are some people within the FDA that are true watchdogs that are very ethical. I know some people that work in the FDA. A friend of mine's wife worked in the FDA, and she took her job very seriously. But some of the higher-ups in the FDA have a different charter. They're looking to protect the medical industry. They're not looking to protect us. Half the funding that goes to the FDA comes from the pharmaceutical industry. In any other industry in the world, you would never have the watchdog over that industry being able to get some of its money from the industry. Why is it permitted in the medical arena? Why is the FDA allowed to get half of its funding from the industry that it's supposed to be a watchdog over? If that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is. You know, so there's a lot there, and it makes me upset because in all the research I'm doing, pharmaceuticals are basically to manage symptoms. They are not created to fix the problem. So that's what I was saying a little while ago. If people would learn to investigate more why they're depressed or why a loved one of theirs is depressed. Sometimes the person's depressed can't even make sense of their life, so they wouldn't be able to do this. But if somebody around them could do the research for them and bring it to them and say, look at what I found. Do you think that we can look into this together? Assist that person until they're thinking a little bit more clearly. There are so many sources of depression, and each one is going to require a different protocol to get that person okay. And in very, very rare situations would it ever require a pharmaceutical antidepressant drug, and even when it does, you're going to want to marry that with some other positive changes for that person so that they don't suffer severe side effects from the antidepressant. I explained to you somebody that's very near to us. Their nephew is on medication right now for a bipolar situation, and they're actually doing very well. But they married that with other lifestyle protocols that are very, very holistic in nature, and so this individual isn't really suffering any of the usual side effects but gaining the benefit of what the drug is supposed to do. So I'm not completely against them, but most people take antidepressants and don't do anything else in a holistic nature. And they're really opening the door for themselves to get worse as time goes on.
Well, that's true in every facet of life, though, honey. That's true. You have people that take responsibility and people who want, one of the very first shows we did, we talked about instant results, instant gratification, instant pleasure, instant everything coming in pill form. And we talked about this at the Institute. So many people would come, spend thousands of dollars to come, but they wanted the Institute to fix them. They didn't want to take responsibility. And, of course, this is an issue, but it can't be addressed on the whole because we're all so different. And some of us take a certain amount of responsibility, and some of us don't. Some of us have so many flaws that starting to work on them becomes so overwhelming that we say, the hell with all of it. So, but the deal is that if you can obviously, if you can mesh lifestyle, check yourself for allergies, do all those kind of things, if you know that every time you eat too much sugar the next day, you can't get out of your own way, you're lethargic, you feel depressed, you don't know why everything was okay and now all of a sudden it's not, chances are it has something to do with not a drug unless you want to call sugar a drug, which some people do. But sometimes that's the issue. So what Shelley's trying to explain is that if you can work on that first, then a lot of times you don't need any of these things. But, of course, we also know that there's only a handful of people that are willing to do that. And even some of the handful of people that I know that are willing to do those things don't do it in any kind of a continuum. They do it for a while, and then they think they've got themselves in a good place, and then they go back to old familiarity, old what the old friends are doing, what the family is doing, what everybody's doing, because then that's how you fit in again. So it is a vicious circle, for sure. Now,
also cultural, because it is our culture.
Absolutely cultural. And absolutely cultural. Mm-hmm.
Right, until 15 years ago, and that's recent. I mean, 15 years ago is really not a long time, okay? But until 15 years ago, I was completely entrenched in the medical industry. For 30 years, I did everything the doctors told me. I looked at doctors as gods. You know, they knew a lot more than I did, I believed at the time, you know. And every time I tried a medical protocol and it didn't work and I was worse off, I was just getting more and more frustrated, you know, and the doctors were getting more and more frustrated because they have cookie-cutter protocols. So if they have 10 people come to them with the same symptom, although that symptom may be from 10 different sources, they're going to give those 10 people the same protocol. It's going to help a couple, and it's not going to help some of the others. It's going to make some of them it's not going to work at all, and some of them it's going to make worse. And that's the problem with the way medicine is done instead of holistic medicine. Holistic medicine looks at the individual. So if they get 10 people with a symptom, they look at the person's entirety. They look at their emotions. They look at their heredity. They look at everything before they set a protocol for that person. And if 10 people come to them with the same symptom, you're going to have 10 different protocols prescribed. That's the difference between holistic medical doctors like naturopaths and medical doctors or specialists, because they have cookie-cutter protocols that they hand out. This is one of the things I'm covering in my book. Oh, and by the way, I was talking about my book with some people yesterday. It looks like the first manuscript's going to be ready in January, so I'm excited about that. It's finally coming to fruition. But that's one of the things I talk about in my book, is that we have a culture that when you get sick, you require a prescription drug. So the pervasive attitude in this country is that when you get sick, you cannot heal your body. We're almost taught this. So people go to the doctor, they're told they're given this drug, you're suffering from depression, take this pill. The reason why people don't investigate further is because they believe that that one pill is supposed to fix them. They don't realize that there's a bigger part of the picture. You're never told all the drugs that I took for those 30 years, I was never warned of any of the side effects. I had to find out on my own. And one time I had a nasty side effect, called the doctor. The doctor started yelling at me, telling me he had never heard of this side effect, that if I didn't want to take the drug, just stop taking it. And he actually got nasty with me. So I got the paperwork out that came with the bottle, and on the back of it, it gave you the 10 most common side effects. What I was suffering from was number 3. And this doctor yelled at me and told me he never heard of it. And it was number 3 out of the top 10 side effects. So, you know, so this is one of the things I talk about. But because of the culture of our country, people don't know to look past what the doctor tells them to do. They take that pill and they expect it to do the whole thing, and they don't realize there's other things they could do along with that pill, that if they still choose that's the right decision for them, to make it work better and to suffer less side effects.
Well, there's a lot of missing parts to many things that come in a doctor's office. Usually, my experience in the last 4 years, and before that with other family members, but very intense the last 4 years between my husband, my son, and my grandson, and my great-grandson, for that matter, I realized that the pharmaceutical business has become so big that there's not a doctor alive that can work a full schedule in the field of a doctoring and still keep up with the pharmaceuticals' input and output. So in most cases, they will hand you a sample that a pharmaceutical company has given to them. Some of the things that I see the most of are things like inhalers, breathing enhancement for people with COPD and different issues like that. And they say, here, try this. You just do this, you bite on the end of it, and you breathe in, and, you know, this works for some people, it doesn't work for others. There's no way in hell that this doctor looked at this. He trusts the fact that the pharmaceutical, one of the richest, most biggest conglomerates in the world, has given it to him, and he figures everybody's tested it, it's okay to give out. And in some cases, it probably is. And I do know some people that use inhalers all the time who have serious asthma, who have allergic issues, things like that, and they use inhalers, albuterol. Half my grandchildren used albuterol. By the time they were two, most of them had had a stint with some kind of an asthmatic issue and had to be on a breathing machine and albuterol. 15 years ago, it seemed to be the catch-all, like we go in cycles with that. But the deal that I'm saying is that there's no doctor, any of them, that really check into that. They don't think it's their job. Just like if you walk in to the heart doctor and you say, something's wrong with my voice, I'm losing my voice. Okay, well, when we get your heart taken care of, we'll send you over to an ENT. They don't look at your throat. They don't ask you what the problem is. They don't do any of that stuff. So
right.
It's all of that whole world, Shelley, is like independent towns that don't ever talk to the town next to it. And I mean
that's
that
right.
Literally. So as you walk through the state of affairs, if you will, each town you go into is just concentrating on what they do in that town and nothing else. I'm
right.
Sure. Big Spike
There's
has had cancer in his throat for over 3 years. And all the doctors that he was going to and all the different things that happened to him, every time I would say, why is he losing his voice? Something's wrong with his voice. They would look in his throat with a flashlight like I could do and say, yeah, it is irritated. We'll give him an antibiotic. And the cancer was growing in there all that time. So does anybody give a shit about that? No. Can I do anything about that to, you know, stop what ended up happening to him? No. And that's what happens. But the drug use that we're talking about today is the kind of drug use where somebody gets given a prescription of 30 Xanax for the month. And in 2 weeks, it's gone. And they're back to the doctor. Then there's people that get 90 Xanax in a month and don't use all of them and knows that they don't use all of them, and they sell them for $30 a bar or whatever they need to do, whatever they can get for it. It's become not just one of our biggest horrors, but it's also become one of our biggest businesses. I know really, really good people. Spike was in a place where we do business, and he said, the guy said, how you doing now, you know, are you better? And he said, yeah. He says, I'm pretty much off the painkillers, which I didn't like the way they made me feel. And the guy, who's, I'm going to guess, late 50s, early 60s, said, you wouldn't have a couple of those you'd like to spare to a good old vacuum cleaner guy, would you?
Oh, wow.
Spike said, no, I don't deal drugs. And so,
wow.
But I mean, that's what the world has become. One of
commercials on TV, they're very cleverly done. You see this older person, man or a woman, walking to a bathroom. One time it was a younger woman, walking to a bathroom, open up the, and they walk into the bathroom, and you see their reflection, and it's a teenager. It's a young girl or a young boy. And whatever they're doing, the reflection is doing the same thing. If they brush their hair, the reflection's brushing their hair, but it's not their reflection. You see them open the medicine cabinet, take out a pill bottle, close it, and then you see their reflection, which is the teenager, opening the pill bottle, taking a pill out, and taking it. Very cleverly done. And the message is, are you keeping track of your medications and who else may be taking them. You know, very cleverly done commercial, but it really drives the point home is that these kids go into the medicine cabinet, they see their parents' or their grandparents' medications, they think because it's a prescription drug it must be safe, so they pop a couple for whatever it makes them feel like without realizing how hazardous that is. First of all, it's just ethically not the right thing to do, but it's a game to them, and then they become addicted to them. Because a lot of these drugs are highly, highly addictive, you know, and they all are.
They really all are. And the longer you take them, the stronger the dose needs to be, or you start doubling up, or you triple up, or whatever you need to do. You know, one of the sites that I went on to, I want to give to everybody. It's called Drug Free World, like it's one word, .org, and there's lots and lots of information on this site. And they talk about the medicine chest, and they talk about prescription drugs, and they have videos that if you're not a good reader, maybe you feel like you don't absorb things when you read, you need to see a video. They have videos on this site. It's a very, very good site, and I'm sure that if you're listening and you're out there and you know that you have a problem, that, of course, right now while you're listening to us talk, you're saying, my problem isn't that big. I just do that when I need to, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're only lying to yourself because Shelley and I really don't care. We probably don't even know you. So you're lying to yourself, first of all, and you're having difficulty in understanding what it is you're doing to yourself. So if you care anything about yourself at all, because you're the most important person to yourself, you need to get on this site and have a look and see if there's something you can do for yourself right away. And obviously, we've talked at length about lifestyle. We've talked at length about the different ways to get yourself to a better place without taking any kind of man-made pharmaceutical. So, and every holistic site you can get into, you can learn about lavender, you can learn about all the different ways to relax, you can learn about a million different things that can bring you to a better place, and you can have a little bit of fun with it, and it's not going to hurt you. But I'd like all of you to know about this site, because it's a good site, and it talks very honestly. I'm going to read this one little part because it says it better than I can say it on my own, but it's the whole point of today's show. After seeing that young man, 20-year-old man, who now is no longer with a family who loved him so much and couldn't do anything to help him, because when you're in that mess, the only one that can clean it up is you. Drugs are essentially poisons. The amount taken determines the effect. A small amount acts as a stimulant, speeds you up. A greater amount acts as a sedative, slows you down. And even larger amounts of poisons can kill you. This is true of any drug. Only the amount needed to achieve the effect differs. But many drugs have another liability. Now listen to this, because if you don't know that this is happening to you, you have to hear this. They directly affect the mind. They can distort the user's perception of what is happening around him or her. As a result, the person's actions may be odd, irrational, inappropriate, and even destructive. Drugs block off all sensations, even the sensations of right and wrong, everybody, even those sensations. The desirable the desirable ones that you want to get rid of, and the ones that you can't or shouldn't or really probably don't even want to, they also get blocked. So while providing short-term help in the relief of pain, they also wipe out ability and alertness and muddy one's thinking. Medicines are drugs that are intended to speed up or slow down or change something about the way your body's working to try to make it work better. Sometimes they are necessary, but they are still drugs. They act as stimulants or sedatives, and too much can kill you. So if you don't use the medicines as they're supposed to be used, they can be as dangerous as illegal drugs.
Right.
So it is what it is. Yes.
And what
this is a lot. Really good site.
One of the things that's so good to understand, and I've mentioned this before on the show when we were talking about addictions and things like that, is that according to the Addictionology College, I forgot what state they're in, but when I had gone through that course and watched all the videos, one of the things that they kept repeating is that a true addict, somebody who becomes an alcoholic, somebody who becomes addicted to drugs or any kind of addiction, has a genetic defect in their brain. They've isolated. Now, there's more than one genetic defect. When I was going through this course, they said they've actually discovered a couple others. The one that got the most attention was the A1 allele dopamine receptor, and people that have this extra gene have the ability to become an addict. Now, the reason why I say the ability to become an addict is because they said that if you don't have this extra dopamine receptor, you cannot become addicted. That there are people that physically cannot, they could sit here and drink alcohol or take drugs or whatever, they would not become addicted to them because their bodies don't have the physiological makeup to become addicted. So that when you see somebody who's addicted, truly addicted, where they go through withdrawal and the whole thing, okay, that means that there is a genetic defect, predisposition, that is physiological, putting them in that state. So now, just that fact alone makes you look at addicts and not addicts very differently. That doesn't mean that the person who's not addicted has a lot more willpower and this and that. I can drink alcohol till I can't stand up anymore. I don't become addicted to it. Even when I was depressed, I went through a 2-year stint once when I was much, much younger, and I drank every night. I did not become addicted. I could stop for a week, nothing happened, and then go through another bad day and then come home that night and drink 3 beers. I never got addicted, but I wanted it. I wanted the beer. I would think about having the beer, but if I went a week or two without having it, I didn't care, and I wouldn't drink until oblivion. So I never became addicted, but for 2 years, I used it as an emotional crutch because I felt better after I had a couple of beers. I never became addicted. Other people in my family were, in fact, alcoholics. And they could not have done what
I
did.
It's a funny thing about alcohol, though. I think alcohol is reflective. And by that, I mean alcohol has a tendency to make you it kind of enhances where you are already, for me. That's what I'm saying. Not for everybody, but for me,
right.
If I drink when I'm angry, look out, because you may be my best friend and I may pick a fight with you. If I drink when I'm sad, all I want to do is cry in my beer. I'm very Irish in regard to that. Very, very Irish. If I'm happy, then you're in for a night of listening to me, sing, and I'll dance all night long, whatever. So it's really a reflection when I do alcohol of what's really going on in me. So probably in my 40s, I learned to not drink when I was depressed or when I was upset about something.
It would
bring it right to the forefront. It was like I took away all my inhibitions, so whatever I was feeling was right there for everybody to see. And I didn't like that. And I still don't like that today. I'm careful with that even today. Not that I do very much drinking anymore, but I still concentrate on, even when all the Golden Girls go out, if I'm in a funny place, I'll sip on one glass of wine and that's it. But if I'm in a really good place, I could have 3 glasses of wine and I would be fine and everything would be good. So I do think that some people are like that, but you have to recognize that in yourself. You know, you have to know that about yourself. But
right, but
one of
talking
the things,
about this young man, the one who overdosed, and he had this wonderful family that loved him and he had his own children and things like that. And the father is so torn up because, you know, now he's realizing that the family is not going to have, especially his young son now, is not going to grow up knowing his father, you know. Mm-hmm. But if people could understand that when you have somebody that is truly addicted, obviously this young man was truly addicted because the suffering he was causing his family wasn't apparent to him. And if it was apparent to him, he lacked the ability to to make better decisions and to stay away from the drugs. When you're a true addict, like what they said just a moment ago, your brain doesn't function properly. Even if you make the decision, you can't act on it because it's almost like there's a dual personality there, and it's a struggle of wills. And there's one part of your brain that's going, I have to have that, I have to have that, I can't function. It muddies your brain so much that all you can think about is doing that drug again. It's almost like you're a split personality. There's another part of you that says, no, if I do that drug, it's going to mess me up. And then there's another part of you that's like, oh, my God, I had to have that because I just can't function without it. And it really is, in my estimation from what I've learned, is that addicts are constantly suffering. And when people don't recognize that, they look at addicts as like a scourge of society. And I don't, but I know people that do, okay? And that's not what it is. These people are suffering. And with a lot of the new information that's out there, there is light at the end of the tunnel. Just because you're an addict doesn't mean you will have an addictive nature your whole life, but you can completely recover from being addicted, whether it's alcohol or drugs or whatever. But you have to deal with this genetic defect. And like I told you in that course, there were all kinds of natural ways, dietary ways. there are deficiencies that these genetic defects cause that actually play into creating depression, because they cause imbalances in how the brain functions and in how the hormones are put into the body. So the more you understand, what I'm trying to say is people should educate themselves. If you are going through this yourself and if you are clear-minded enough where you can research for yourself, because there are some people that are just becoming addicted and they're not entrenched so much to like nip it in the bud, learn as much as you can. It's called addictionology, and I highly, highly recommend that people start researching that. There's a college, I think it's out in the Midwest. Find out if they have resources. I'll probably have to do that for one of our future shows, see if there's actually resources that people can get on their own. This was a course that I had gotten, but I'm thinking there must be other types of resources for family and friends. Or if you see somebody in that, educate yourself first before you approach this person. They don't suggest the interventions anymore. Like, remember that show Intervention where the family would that they would trick the person and then they'd get them in a room with everybody and they'd hand them letters and stuff? Well, the new concept of intervention is not to do it that way, because that only had like a 30% success rate. The people would be so offended that they were pulled in, because you got to remember, their brains are not working right, okay? They were so offended that a lot of them would either take off or go deeper into their habit. They only had about a 30% success rate. Now the way they do interventions is by educating the family and friends first and then inviting this individual to an intervention, saying, look, we all love you. This is what we're doing. We're sitting down tonight to see if, as a family, we can figure out an action plan for you. Whether you show up or not, we're having that meeting. And they say that more than 95% of the people show up because they don't want people talking about them when they're not there. And they have something like an 82% success rate with these types of interventions, that they're able to get through to the person and inspire them to do something to get help to turn their lives around. And that's a very, very dramatic statistic. This was a few years ago. I'm hoping that the statistics are still that high. But this is what I'm thinking about this young man. And the family probably didn't even know how to approach him or how to explain to him why he wasn't able to just stop doing this drug on his own, even with this beautiful family around him.
Mm-hmm. Well, because he was addicted, and that's, I have to share this, though, because while you were talking, I was able to look up the drug that this young man was addicted to, and I am blown away by something.
Wow.
This drug is, you know how when you buy a cough syrup, it says DXM or DM on the bottle?
Yeah.
That's what this is. Dextromethorphan Methorphan. And it is the main ingredient in Benylin DM, Mucinex DM, Robitussin,
oh, wow.
NyQuil, Dimetapp, Vicks, Coricidin, Delsym, Theraflu, and others. It comes syrups, tablets, sprays, or lozenger form. And if you have it in its virgin form, it is a white powder. So I know everybody I know takes something in that list that I just named off, especially if they have a cold or if they've got the flu.
I was younger.
Yeah.
I never got addicted to it, but I actually had a friend of mine when I was growing up in New York. This was about maybe 20, 25 years ago. We worked together. They were addicted to NyQuil. Now I understand why. I could not figure out how this person got addicted to NyQuil. I thought it was the alcohol in it. I bet it was the DXM.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says recreational use is over-the-counter preparations containing dextromorphin have been used in manners consistent with their labeling, often as a recreational drugs. At doses much higher than medically recommended, DXM and its major metabolite, dextrorphin, acts as an NMDA receptor antagonist, which produces similar effects to, yet distinct from, the dissociative hallucinogenic states created by other dissociative anesthetics such as ketamine and phencyclidine. It may produce distortions of a visual field, feelings of dissociation, distorted bodily perception, and excitement, as well as a loss of sense of time. Some users report stimulant-like euphoria, particularly in response to music. DMX usually provides its recreational effects in a nonlinear fashion so that they are experienced in significantly varied stages. These stages are commonly referred to as plateaus. So that would explain why this young boy was foaming at the mouth and bleeding from his ears and his nose and everything. So in rare side effects, you get respiratory depression. And it's got a list of if you overdo the amount that you do of it. And that is even true if you do it in the prescribed bottle, the Mucinex, all the things that I named off before. I'm caught up on Mucinex because Big Spike has been using Mucinex since he first got sick because he gets so much phlegm in his throat after all the radiation and all the and the carotid surgery and having everything numbed there. He doesn't get regular saliva. He gets a very, very thick mucus. And the Mucinex, all the doctors told us we could use it. Of course, he doesn't overdo it ever. I mean, you know, he might take one a day. But I'm glad I looked this up because this is a big heads up. So if you notice any difference like this, especially if you have, like, say, a 7-year-old and you think you've got some of that in the house that's an adult dosage, you might want to rethink that. So we're out of time. Our hearts go out to this family, and we appreciate what he posted because it gave us more food for thought. So everybody go out today and have a great, great day. Very rainy here in South Florida, but I see in our more northern Midwestern states, it's snowing like crazy. So everybody go out and have a great day. God bless. Be back tomorrow. It's Bullies to Buddies Day. I hope you'll join us. We have a special guest on Wednesday. We're going to talk about relationships and the search for Prince Charming. So please join us. Thanks, Shell. Yeah.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.